Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. If we needed another reason to support the health care law, how about this? Rush Limbaugh says that if it passes, he'll leave the country. Yes, we have no tomatoes. Father Murphy has died. Doctors get paid less than nurses. The Bank of America is reducing fees. That's right, reducing fees. The Bank of America, really. Highway deaths are down. A bad economy is part of the reason. Thank you, George Bush. Soon-to-be former Congressman Eric Massa allegedly has a habit of groping men. And it started a long time ago. Well, recuse me, says Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. Surprise, surprise. Another medical test is found to be overdone. Angiograms designed to see if someone has a blockage very rarely find one, but they cost you a lot of money. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be me. We've got all of those stories, books we like, all the news of the weird. There are some really good ones, so stand by. And we've got a return visit from a great guest, Larry Hancock, who tonight will be joining us to talk about the murders of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr., and he'll more specifically be telling us about his upcoming book with regard to Dr. King's killing. But first, that cup of coffee feels great in your hands. The aroma goes right to your brain as you breathe it in. The cabin's warming up for the family because you had the foresight to get the fireplace going, and now the smell of that wood is mixing with your coffee. It took time and work to get to the point that you could just get up and go to your cabin whenever you wanted to. But it also took being smart. You were smart enough, for example, to know that if you're in business and have a website, you're really in business when you're also blogging. You went to Jeff on Blogging. .blogspot.com and chose Blog Wizardry to write your blogs for you. It was inexpensive, it was well done, and it increased traffic to your website and your company. Even though the cabin's getting nice and toasty, you can hear the wind blowing through the trees and get a sense of the brisk outside air. What was that noise? You go to the window. A doe and her fawn. It's going to be a good day. Blog Wizardry. Jeff on blogging.blogspot.com. And we're back. Wanted to talk to you about the news stories, but first I wanted to tell you about our phone number and also tell you about last week's guest. For those of you who tuned in and perhaps soon tuned out, he will be back. I'll come back to that in just a second. If you'd like to call and talk about politics, economics, pretty much everything. The show is called Speaking of Everything for a reason. We speak about pretty much everything, as long as you promise not to get on the phone and quote the Bible. But other than that, you're in good shape. The phone number to call in is area code 347-994-3796. And I should have added, if you believe in the Bible, that's fine. I have nothing against you having that belief. But hearing people say, well, as you know, as it says in Leviticus, tends to get just a touch boring really quickly. Before I do that, let me also tell you that the guest I was referring to is Cecil Bothwell. Couldn't make it last week, but he will be joining us in a couple of weeks. So keep tuning into the program. We actually do have it scheduled. I just don't have the date right before me. And he is a city councilman in Asheville, North Carolina, who certain people tried to keep out of office after he was elected because he is a self-proclaimed atheist. That's something worth tuning into. I think you'll find it both interesting and kind of amusing. We have no tomatoes refers to the fact that there was a freeze in Florida which killed most of the crop down there, and some fast food restaurants are not offering tomatoes on their sandwiches. Others are only giving it to you when you specifically ask for it. Don't know how many of you will remember this, but there was another problem with the crops, and specifically tomatoes, I think about a year, year and a half ago. And even salad bar restaurants weren't offering tomatoes, not because they weren't available at all, but because they were so expensive. So it created the rather peculiar situation where you would go into a salad bar restaurant and they wouldn't have one of the items that you tend to depend on for salad. But those days quickly ended, fortunately, but they presumably may come back because of this freeze. We mentioned Father Murphy. Father Murphy was the name of a TV show back in, I'm guessing now because I don't remember, back I guess in the 80s, starring Merlin Olsen, who before that had been in been on the show Little House on the Prairie, and even before that was a professional football player. After the Father Murphy show, became a spokesperson for one of the florists. I want to say FTD, but I'm not sure of that. In any event, Merlin Olsen died at the age of 69 today after a battle with cancer. A story has developed that in certain places, nurses are actually being paid more than doctors, more than physicians. And the basic story is as follows. Though there's a shortage of family doctors throughout the country, some medical centers last year offered higher salaries incentives to specialist nurses than to primary care doctors. This is based on a survey they do of physicians' salaries. They do this, well, it's annual, so I guess they do it every year. The primary care doctors were offered an average base salary of $173,000 in 2009, which isn't bad, but the nurses who are certified nurse anesthetists, certified registered nurse anesthetists, or CRNAs, they were offered $16,000 more on average, $189,000. And the company who did this search, Merritt Hawkins and Associates, says that they project in 2010 that the disparity is still going to be there, except it'll be a little smaller. Instead of a $16,000 disparity, there'll be about an $8,000 disparity between about $178,000 and $186,000. So, mom, tell your sons and daughters to become certified registered nurse anesthetists, because that's where the, if you're just talking about money, that is where it seems to be. This is the fourth year in a row that they received or were recruited at higher pay than a family doctor, and they've tended to be pretty high because they're necessary, necessary may be the wrong word. They are very useful in surgeries. If the choice is to utilize their services as opposed to a physician who's also an anesthesiologist, so although they make apparently some good money, they're still cheaper than the specialized doctors as contrasted with the family docs. Wanted to give out the phone numbers again. It's 347 area code, and the rest of the number goes 994-3796. A story we didn't mention, but I want to mention now, not because it's in the News of the Weird section, but it is kind of odd. Some of you have heard commercials for a company called LifeLock, and the CEO of the company has given out his Social Security number saying he's so confident of the quality of LifeLock service that he gives out his Social Security number because he knows his identity, because he's not just the president but a subscriber. It's so safe that his identity can't be stolen. Maybe not so much. The first problem is that the company has agreed to settle charges brought against it by the Federal Trade Commission, essentially for false advertising, or that it misled consumers in any event. They are paying out $12 million, probably from your bank account, but no, they are paying out $12 million. And this was as a result of a lawsuit brought against them by the FTC and 35 state attorneys general. The settlement agreement also requires them to refrain from making further deceptive claims, and they need to take even more stringent measures to safeguard personal information that it collects from consumers, because it turns out several hundred persons who were LifeLock customers, guess what, became victims of identity fraud while using the company's services. The service is really inexpensive, but if your identity is going to get stolen, The $10 a month is probably not worth it. In any event, they also claimed that they did fraud alerts, which they placed on credit files, but the FTC said that only protected against certain kinds of identity theft of a type that's only amounting to about 20% of all of that which is done. Although the CEO, whose name is Todd Davis, but I'm not giving you his social security number, said that his views differ on what the intent of the message was, they have agreed to follow this requirement of the FTC. They didn't really have much of a choice. And he said that it sets a standard for the industry. Well, yeah. The Illinois Attorney General said that most of what is offered by LifeLock, people can do on their own, and except for a couple of things, and those aren't terribly successful. It turns out that after the CEO, Todd Davis, was broadcasting his Social Security number, turns out at least one attempt to secure credit using his Social Security number worked. A man in Texas secured a $500 payday loan using his Social Security number. I think maybe he needs to subscribe to an additional service. The Bank of America has been, not just the Bank of America, but other banks as well, have been chastised and criticized by a number of consumer advocates, because what they were doing, most banks, is if you had a debit card, you could go into the, let's say, restaurant, order a pizza to go, and put it on your debit card, and, of course, go. The debit card would be the amount purchased would be debited against your checking account. However, if you didn't have enough money in the, if you don't have enough money in your account when you do that, what will happen is the bank will actually let the charge go through, but then charge you a fee because of the fact that they essentially were advancing the money to make your debit good, and they were charging fees of like $35 for this. Now, what they were doing was legal, because when you signed on for your account and got your debit card, it was in all of the long litany of gobbledygook that is in those agreements, and so you were signing. Nobody reads those things. You're legally bound by the terms of something you sign, and of course we all should read those agreements, but nobody reads those things. So you, in many cases, don't know that that's what's going to happen. More to the point, even if you know it's going to happen, when you go make that charge against your checking account, unless you're keeping track, if you don't know that you don't have the money in there to cover it, you don't know that the pizza you bought last night and the shoes you're buying this morning are going to cost you a bunch of extra money. So what the Bank of America has done, well, first off, let me back up. The Federal Deposit Insurance Commission has entered new rules, has created new rules, which take place in a few months, or take effect. But the Bank of America has gone a little farther. The description goes essentially as this. The new rules prevent banks from automatically enrolling you in the overdraft protection. But Bank of America, and again, that's due to take effect, I believe, in August. But here's what Bank of America is doing. They said they are going to ditch the overdraft fees unless you say it's okay. What they're going to do is that when you attempt to do that pizza purchase, in my example, you will get notified that there's insufficient money to cover it, but they'll go ahead and do the purchase for you if you want to. You have to push a button or something. And at that point, you will be charged the $35 overdraft fee if you continue. But if you don't want to continue, clearly you've just saved $35 and probably have gone somewhere else where you're going to eat a meal that's healthier than that pizza you ordered. But at least you're not going to have that overdraft charge, where before you wouldn't have known about it, perhaps. So you get the choice at the time of purchase. That's new. They're going to start doing that for new customers who go to get their accounts at the Bank of America beginning in June, and for existing customers, they're starting that in August. That's not required by the new rules from the FDIC, so this is going a little further, and to that extent, they're to be commended. We talked about, the bad economy being partially responsible for the reduction in highway deaths. This is amazing. I remember when highway deaths every year were about 50,000. And that's when I was, that's about 20 years ago. So I must have been, six. In those days, they talked about 50,000 deaths on the highway pretty much all the time. It was in all of the public service announcements about buckle your seatbelts and all that stuff. Well, now they've been going down for quite some time. But now they took a deep dive. Traffic deaths look like they don't have all the numbers in yet, but it looks like they declined 9% in 1 year, 2009, to 33,963. In 2008, the number of people killed on the highways were 37,261. The important point is there was a seriously large decline, 9%, in 1 year, which is the lowest number of people killed on the nation's highways since, anybody want to guess? 1954. It's been, 56 years since the, or 55, because that was 2009, since the numbers were that low. And they say it's because, of course, people buckling up the fact that cars have more safety features. Right. The truth turns out to be a little more complex. Turns out that the economy has so cut down traveling by people by car that there are fewer people out there. So the note I made at the beginning of the show may be correct if you believe, as I do, that this economy soured. Well, it's not a matter of belief, it's a matter of fact, that the economy was souring during the last year of the Bush administration. Thank you, George Bush. Thank you, Hank Paulson. You've reduced the number of deaths on the highway, and you didn't even know you were doing it. The Attorney General of New York, the state of New York, has pulled himself out of the investigation concerning Governor David Patterson of New York. As many of you know, meaning anyone who's opened a newspaper or looked at the news on the web lately, Governor Patterson is in some difficulty. He's been involved, at least allegedly, in several scandals, and he's decided not to run again as a result, but says he's going to finish his term. Well, an investigation was undertaken earlier by the Attorney General's office, and Cuomo is taking himself out of that because he believes there may be a conflict. The real conflict is that Cuomo wants to be governor. Actually, that's not quite true. Cuomo wants to be president, but he's going to start with governor from where he is. He was a cabinet official in the Clinton administration. He is the son, of course, of former governor Andrew Cuomo. Of Mario Cuomo. I apologize. Andrew is the son. And Mario Cuomo was governor of New York and probably should have been president of the United States, but chose not to run in the year that he was most likely to win, which was 1992. He would have run against the first President Bush, and he declined to run thinking that nobody could beat him. And someone obviously did. But in any event, his son now is a political power in the state of New York, and my guess is he'll probably be the next governor. But he did have the brains to remove himself from that. In about 10 minutes, maybe less, Larry Hancock is going to be joining us. So if you would like to hear about the assassinations and the plots and the cover-ups related to Dr. King and the late Senator Kennedy, I'm referring to Bobby Kennedy, then please stay with us and feel free to call in after he's joined us. Obviously, you're welcome to join us before to talk about other things, but if you want to talk about those things, if you have questions or you wanted to share some knowledge you have that may not be broadly possessed, it's 347-994-3796. Wanted to tell you about another odd news story that took place in, I believe it was Maryland. A teacher there, Montgomery County, is apologizing now after she had the brilliant idea of referring to one of her female students as looking like a prostitute and having a security guard remove the girl from the class. The student was wearing a T-shirt and two pairs of leggings to a class in Seneca Valley High School. As the child recalls it, her teacher said, "Look at the way she's dressed, like a prostitute." At the teacher's request, a security guard escorted the student to the front office, but the administrators told her that there was nothing wrong with what she was wearing. So the student, who is a cheerleader, but sounded much smarter, actually, and her parents were outraged by the teacher's comments, of course, and the mother called the school, the superintendent, and, of course, an attorney. Teacher called to apologize, and that basically is what's happened. The director of school performance said that the school will be taking appropriate measures. Okay, I can think of one. In any event, I wanted to tell you about the angiogram research study that just came out. An angiogram is a and I am looking to our staff nurse to make sure I say this right. An angiogram is a diagnostic test whereby a catheter is pushed through the arteries to determine whether there's a blockage. Right? Blockages are a problem, of course, because they cut off the supply of blood to the heart and from the heart. And if you have that blockage, you can have a heart attack. The time you order an angiogram is if you have some met or stroke. Yes, thank you. and more remarks from the studio audience will be present in a moment. But anyway, the tests are normally or are supposed to be ordered when there is a reasonably high level of risk of a blockage in the artery. You don't want to do this test unnecessarily. First off, it costs money, and it costs a fair amount. In most cases, insurance covers it for those who have insurance, and therefore people don't think about the cost. But it's fairly expensive. But they over-recommend the test, according to the study. And one of the ways they've determined that is that most angiograms result in a negative finding. That is to say, there is no blockage. Now, that's a very nice thing to hear. You don't have a blockage, or the blockage is not enough to be concerned with. But at the same time, there was no need to do the test. Now, it doesn't say that there's not a good reason to order the test. Some of those times where there's no result, like no blockage, but apparently it's over-ordered. And the other thing that's wrong with doing this is, first off, it also it exposes the patient to a little bit of radiation. And the radiation in your body is cumulative. As you age, it becomes more and more of a serious problem because more and more radiation is hitting you, and x-rays that we get all the time and all the rest, and ambient radiation become more of a problem. But additionally, in about 1%, one out of every 100 patients who receive an angiogram, just less than that, the patient has a heart attack or stroke because of the procedure. Okay, so please stand back. Do not rush forward now to volunteer for your angiogram. It's a strange world with the angiograms and the mammograms and the colonoscopies. And I should tell you that when I just said colonoscopies, my hand went in an arc moving up, as if it were an instrument that were going to do that job. And that was unconscious, but it's a strange thing. You can't see it, of course, but which is just as well, because then you would see the rest of me. But it's just a strange occurrence that as you talk, you have a tendency to make hand gestures that you're not even conscious of until you see what you're doing and realize how silly it is. Frequently, I don't know if any of you have this occur, I've often been on the phone with someone, and I've said, "Look, there are two reasons for that," and I hold up two fingers because, you know, we all know that if you say two without holding up two fingers, it doesn't count. Before Larry joins us, I wanted to tell you about a couple of books I've just recently read that I recommend to you. One is The Narrows by Michael Conley, and the other one is called Night Pills, written by an author I had never read before named John Lutz, L-U-T-Z. And Conley writes a series of books about a police detective named Harry Bosch. The Narrows is a very, very good story, and it's a revisiting of a character, a villain, who Bosch had put away, essentially, before, apparently, by the name of the poet. And I believe the earlier book was, in fact, called The Poet. That was also quite good. Night Kills was a book that was given to me by a friend who said, you're going to like this guy, and he was right. The writing is very tight. If you like mysteries, the books are for you. Well, we may not get an opportunity to go to News of the Weird tonight, and there were some really good stories, but we'll save them for next week because I think that we have joining us now Larry Hancock. Larry, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you, sir. I'm fine. Happy spring is starting to be here.
Okay. How warm has your spring day been today or yesterday?
Today was at least in the 50s.
Okay. Then I don't want to tell you how warm it was here in Arizona. It's not a lot warmer. It's still the tail end of our winter, but our winter is like a lot of people's springs. So there you are. We've had an enormous amount of rain this year. We've had a drought for quite some time, and this year we've had a lot of rain. But I wanted to say first that Larry is the author of Someone Would Have Talked, and we've interviewed him twice before, right?
Yeah, right.
Twice. This is your third visit, right, about the assassination of John Kennedy. And for those of you who are too young to remember or who have read a book in your life, he was the 35th president of the United States, served from 1961 to November 22nd, 1963, the date on which he was killed. And Larry has a book about that and the cover-up and new evidence, and we talked about that. He's also written and is soon to be publishing a book on the assassination of Martin Luther King, right?
Yes, sir, I am. January.
And that's just, 9 months away?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's great. And obviously you'll join us when that book is about to be published so that everyone can be reminded of it, please. This is an invitation now for that time.
I'd love to, absolutely.
Okay, all right. And what's that book called?
It's called Bringing Armageddon.
What, say it again?
Bringing Armageddon.
Bringing Armageddon. It sounded, because of the, there was a little transmission problem in the sound, it sounded like Brain Armageddon.
Oh.
But it was I have one of those every day, but this was Bringing Armageddon.
Probably my accent, actually.
I don't think that was it. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and get into it. But before we do, let me give out the number again in case someone wants to join us and ask you questions. And my guess is we'll probably just be the two of us. But in case someone does want to join us, it's 347-994-3796. I will also tell you, Larry, that on the shows you've been on before, we have had much larger audience than we do on some shows. Not that the guests we have on those shows are not wonderful, but you apparently bring an audience with you.
Well, that's
so
great.
I don't know.
We do tell a few people.
Okay. I was going to say, I don't know if you're aware of that or you're responsible for some of that in terms of letting people know you're going to be on, but there is a lot of interest when you are on the show. So let's go ahead and get into it. Let's first talk about the subject of your book, and then if we have time, we'll talk about Bobby Kennedy. Tell us the official story about the Martin Luther King assassination, and then why it's nonsense.
Well, the official story actually rests pretty basically in the fact that James Earl Ray was arrested for the crime. There was a considerable amount of evidence left at the crime scene pointing towards him, all sorts of personal materials, the rifle. There was relatively clear evidence trailed to him. It was virtually impossible to deny that he'd been there, that he'd been in position to take the shot, that he'd bought a rifle associated with the shooting, and that he had tried to escape and fled the country. So that sets up the story pretty well, and what kind of put the quick close to it is that when the matter went to court, he pled guilty.
Right.
So there really wasn't a contentious trial. Essentially, the trial consisted of the prosecutor presenting his evidence for the prosecution and the defense simply taking the guilty plea and saying, we're done, like to avoid the death penalty if possible. And that was about there
really wasn't actually a trial per se, was there? Wasn't it just a case of how do you plead Mr. Ray? And he said guilty, and they said, all right, here's the sentence?
Well, you would think that, but actually, no, what they did is they entered the plea. Ray placed a couple of remarks with the judge, asked to make a couple of remarks to the judge, and interestingly enough, the remarks that he made were simply to state that he took exception to the fact that the Attorney General and J. Edgar Hoover had said that there was no sign of a conspiracy or any others being associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
He took exception to that remark and then sat down, and the judge did let the prosecutor present a considerable case of evidence, and the sort of thing he would have gone through, but it was pretty much one-sided because he only presented evidence for prosecution. So there wasn't really a trial, except it allowed evidence to be placed in the record.
Okay. So that's what occurred. Now, unlike the JFK assassination, essentially, Ray really was involved, correct?
Yes. It's one of the things that gives Ray away in being involved at all, because eventually, well, just to finish that story, just a few days after the guilty plea was entered and the judge was in process of going through sentencing, and Ray entered a request to reopen and withdraw his plea. So he turned around almost immediately and certainly would have tied the whole process up. And shortly after, the judge still had his paperwork in hand. Actually, the judge passed away. But so Ray pled guilty. It made some objection to remarks that there was no conspiracy and then almost immediately withdrew his guilty plea. So it left a pretty confusing situation. But one of the things is clear, and this was exposed by a fellow that worked with Ray very early on, writing some articles about the crime. And what gives Ray away is that actually he traveled from Los Angeles to Atlanta, where King lived and where King was.
Right.
But on the way, he made a detour of about 65, 70 miles off the main freeway to go to Selma, Alabama, where Martin Luther King was speaking or scheduled to speak. Well, as it turns out, King often changed his appointments and his schedule at the very last minute, so he ended up being about 25 miles away from where Ray was. But Ray was very hard-pressed to explain why he would go off a major freeway to a small town unless he had an interest in Dr. King, and eventually admitted to the author and that, yes, he had been... he had been there because of Richard and King. So it's very hard to make a case that Ray was not focused on King.
Yeah, unless, of course, you accept the notion that he wanted to visit lovely Selma, Alabama.
Well, yes. I mean, he'd traveled widely, and, you never know.
Yeah. Okay, so after that, of course, he went to Memphis.
He went to Atlanta and actually spent some time in Atlanta, moved into a boarding house. And but he left Atlanta and went to Birmingham twice and ended up buying the gun that was left at the site of the King assassination. That gun was purchased not in Atlanta but in Birmingham. And again, it gets to be a very convoluted story unless you think there's more than going on than just James Earl Ray. And that's where you get involved in the larger story, because even though Ray is obviously has something in mind in regard to King, there's a lot of evidence to show that there were people behind him and people associated with him.
Right. Now, before you get into that, let's talk for a minute about what Dr. King was doing in Memphis, and also the kind of person that James Earl Ray was. I'm not talking about the fact that he was far from a Boy Scout, but I mean what his background was. But talk first about what Dr. King was doing in Memphis, because keep in mind, a lot of the people who are listening to us are a touch younger than you and I are, and may not,
yes,
may not remember.
I have to face that, yes.
yeah, please, go ahead.
But basically, Dr. King's focus and agenda had shifted a lot during 1966 to 1968. And by 1968, he was he was largely focusing on economics as it applied to civil rights and improving the economic plight of the blacks. And for whites. And he was active throughout the country. It wasn't just the South. He had had a major campaign in Chicago. And his real focus was, as you say, he was putting together a poor people's campaign. Black, white, poor people's, an economic focus. And the poor people's campaign was really his focus. And he was aiming towards a major march and demonstration in Washington, D.C. to bring up the plight of the poor.
Right. He had also come out against the Vietnam War a couple of years earlier, which is the beginning of the shift you were just referring to.
He had, And interestingly enough, for those people that weren't here, what had been a really almost unique opposition to the Vietnam War when he first did it a year earlier had pretty much almost become mainstream by the spring of 1968. It was no longer a lone voice and had gone on to other things, as a matter of fact, the economics. But he was diverted. The reason he was in Memphis basically was because a sanitation worker strike in Memphis had turned into a real civil rights conflict, and they had requested, he was friends with some of the Memphis people, and they had asked him to come help. And he had gone in to participate in a march earlier in the year, and unfortunately for him, because he was just being invited in, it really wasn't planned and organized like one of his normal events was, and the thing had degenerated into a rather violent protest, and there was a lot of violence going on, and actually it put him in the position of, there were people saying that he could not go to Washington, D.C. and do a protest without violence, and basically he was backed into a corner saying, well, we have to prove to people that we can demonstrate peacefully, so we've got to go back to Memphis, and we've got to make this thing work, and that's why he was in Memphis at the time of the assassination.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say, and please feel free to disagree or add something here, that Dr. King had become not just a person who was, I mean, we already discussed this, not just trying to improve the lot of African Americans, but by virtue of what he was doing, if he had been successful at organizing poor people as a class of folks to do a demonstration and to seek economic rights, that actually was, for certain interests in this country, fairly dangerous, because we really don't have never had a real class consciousness in this country, with the possible exception of the Depression period, and maybe not even really then.
We've not focused on economics the way he was beginning to focus on economics. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, we have not. And that would have, especially at the height of the war, when you know, you're trying to juggle a war in Southeast Asia along with Johnson's program, you know, for domestic improvements, it would have been a strain for everyone. But another thing, and I'd say probably equally important, is Dr. King remained one of the very few remaining proponents of totally peaceful protest. A lot of his former allies and fellow travelers in the civil rights movement had been beaten up so badly by that point in time that, you know, they were shifting away, and there was a lot of, we were there, I was on campus, the anti-war protests were getting more violent. Basically, one of the things you're left with is Dr. King was still trying to prove that you could do it peacefully, while a lot of the other movements were shifting into being much more confrontational.
Yeah. I just wanted to allude to a phrase you used. You used the expression fellow travelers, and I know you didn't mean it this way, but they used to, I'm sure you'll remember once I mention it, they used to refer to people as fellow travelers who were communist sympathizers.
Right.
I know that's not what you meant. Right.
Now, that was from the 50s.
That was what?
That was from the 50s.
Right, exactly.
So I'm just literally talking about fellow perhaps
participants in the movement. Yeah.
The movement. I was going to say the movement would probably be the right term.
Okay. So that's what Dr. King was doing in Memphis, and that's why he was on one level somewhat dangerous. Talk about prior to the King assassination, what kind of career, if you will, James Earl Ray had?
James Earl Ray was definitely a career criminal. There's no mm-hmm. doubt about it. He had spent the latter part of his life in federal penitentiaries. Early on, he had been engaged in some minor thefts, petty crime. He had held a real job in a shoe factory for a couple of years. He'd gone into the Army and got into a great deal of difficulty in the Army over a variety of violations, from theft to AWOL. But eventually, mm-hmm. once he got out of the Army, it was just one crime after another, whether it was burglary or armed robbery. And he had, as I say, had spent years in various federal penitentiaries. And I think,
right.
from my perspective, one of the issues that you have to face with James Earl Ray is he was an experienced convict, and he had learned a lot in prison. And he knew how to play the system. He knew how to game the system. He knew, he's a jailhouse lawyer. He'd tried to represent himself before. So he's definitely been around the block from that perspective. He had committed armed robbery, attempted armed robbery, nothing ever with a rifle, but with pistol.
Mm-hmm.
He was, if you really study his criminal career, he was reasonably good at planning. He had gotten to be pretty good at escapes because he kept getting caught, because he wasn't really good on crimes. I mean, there are a number of crimes he committed where they have this great plan and they have escape vehicles and they're going to switch cars and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get in the middle of it, and it just all comes apart.
Falls apart, yeah.
Yeah, it just – so he's not that great in the heat of the moment, actually, from his
right.
record. But one thing you can rely on is he will never admit anything. I think one of my favorite crimes is he attempted a burglary. So he had gotten into this building, and the police are checking, and they see this car parked outside the building. It makes them suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
So they start to go in the building, but first they take off the distributor, and so he can't get away. So they get in the building. He jumps out a back window. But
before you go on, Larry, you have to explain, because not everyone is necessarily mechanically inclined. What you're saying is they took off the distributor cap from the vehicle that was parked in front.
Right, from the plug, so the engine will
gotcha.
No longer fire.
Go ahead, please.
This car is not going anywhere. So
mm-hmm.
he jumps out the back, but the problem is it's been raining, and it's very muddy, and his shoes get stuck. So he,
mm-hmm.
he's got to run off, and he runs off barefooted. And so the next morning, a town marshal picks him up walking down the railroad track barefooted at about 6
mm-hmm.
o'clock in the morning, and thinks that's a little suspicious. And James says, well, I was just out for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
And so... sometimes his alibis aren't that good, but he even defended himself in that crime in court and definitely ended up in jail.
Right.
But just to give a feel for the man.
Okay. Now, and with regard to the King assassination, things were a little different for Mr. Ray, as contrasted with his criminal career. How were they different?
Well, for one thing, interestingly enough, by that point in time, as I say, he had gotten pretty good, or much more educated escapes. He had actually been an escaped prisoner for
mm-hmm.
something like a year at the time that crime occurred.
Hmm.
And as an escaped, he escaped from a federal prison. He had traveled through Canada and attempted to escape from the continent and leave Canada and go overseas, and that had not worked out. He had traveled all the way back across the country to Mexico and spent a couple of months in Mexico, on the west coast of Mexico, Acapulco, Puerto Vallarta, come back to Los Angeles, and had been living in Los Angeles for a couple of months. So he actually, had managed to travel and to move around as an escaped convict very successfully. And had maintained
mm-hmm.
a low profile and was obviously, I laughed at his earlier escape, but obviously the man had learned a lot of techniques by the time
right.
he got to 1968. One thing I should add, though, and I think you did not ask this, but I should have brought it up. One thing is that he had a history of, in regard to the King assassination, He certainly had no history of violent racism,
right,
or joining racist groups, or you know, participating in any activity like that. Although the records make it clear that when he was in prison and you know, otherwise, he did. He got into fights over the issue. He refused it. He was definitely opposed to integration, let's say.
Right.
And
yeah.
So he, but not a militant racist, I guess you would say.
Right. So what you're saying in part by that statement is you would not have guessed that if he were acting out of just his own feelings, his own anger, it seems unlikely that he would have been so angry at the idea of a powerful black man or of a civil rights leader or anything like that. He would not normally be motivated by racist impulses alone to go ahead and commit that crime if, in fact, he was just self-motivated.
Now, there's no indication of that at all. And his we know his movements and his interest over the, you know, the previous year in great detail because of the investigations. And one of the things that's clear continuously is he, in Canada and in Mexico and even in Los Angeles, he was constantly looking for ways to get out of the country. I mean, he was an escaped federal prisoner, and he was looking for ways to go overseas and had written letters and actually expressed an ongoing interest in traveling to places like Rhodesia, somewhere in Africa, but there's no indication that he was had any intent to stay in the U.S. and do anything particular in the U.S. He was just trying to get enough money to get away, basically.
Right. So he comes to Memphis, and in April of 1968, he, of course, in some fashion, sets himself up to kill Dr. King.
And
the question is, go ahead.
And he knows, we have to accept again, it's many things that James Earl Ray says, and I think this is one of the problems we have, is a lot of people have taken him at his word about various things.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make a credible case that Ray tells you what he wants you to hear if it's to his advantage, and if it's not to his advantage, you're not going to hear it, or you're going to hear something entirely different. So
Right. Dealing
with Ray as a source is extremely difficult.
Sure. But the question I was going to ask you is, okay, his own racism wasn't the issue. He was involved in the killing. He undoubtedly was the shooter. So the question becomes, what's his motivation?
There's almost universal agreement all the way from his brothers to basically anyone who ever knew him that Ray's interest was money.
Mm-hmm.
Ray was motivated throughout his life just in it, and to get money, and not to do it in little pieces, but to do, you know, fairly good-sized robberies, whether they were grocery stores or banks or, you know. So his motivation is to get money, and in this case, his interest has been to get enough money to be able to successfully go overseas and establish, you know, to escape internationally and establish himself overseas. So even the House Select Committee reinvestigated the crime and reached the same conclusion. It's hard to escape the fact that Ray was not looking for money. And actually there are any number of leads suggesting that he had heard that there was money being offered for the murder of King.
Okay. And so then we get to the next question. Who was doing the offering?
Generally, there were several offers on the table. There were a couple of concrete offers. For example, we can trace a $100,000 offer that was being circulated in several federal prisons, including the ones James was in, to the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, which was a Mississippi organization.
Yeah. And do we actually know who it is that James Earl Ray actually got money from to perform this act, to the extent he did get money?
I can't tell you now that we can connect all the dots. We're
okay.
Close. We've got a lead, for example, to a man who visited him in Los Angeles, who looks like he was carrying the offer. And that was the FBI actually checked that out and matched an individual in their files who was from the South, including who had been in Jackson, Mississippi. We have leads from Atlanta that talk about specific individuals that are on record as saying of how money was collected to make the payment, how money was transferred to Jackson, Mississippi for the payment, people that Ray contacted in Atlanta. But can you put it all together? It hasn't gelled to that extent yet, and I wouldn't misrepresent it that it was was tied down that tightly yet. It's a lot closer now than it was before, but it's not. There's no bow on it.
Okay, I want to come back to that in a second, but first I wanted to ask you your website address so that if someone is interested in the JFK book, they can get it there, and of course they can keep checking back and listening to our show, of course, so that you're on. And I want to talk to you about doing this again because we're obviously not going to get to the Bobby Kennedy killing tonight. But even after that, you'll be back when the book comes out on Dr. King's killing. But your website.
It's www.larry-hancock.com.
There you go. So if you're interested in the JFK book, which we didn't talk about tonight, but we talked about on a couple of other occasions, you can also hear that those shows, if you're interested, by coming to the same place you came to hear this at blogtalkradio.com/Jeff-Bushman, or dash Bushman, if you wish, B-U-S-H-M-A-N. And the shows that Larry has done before are there in archive form, so you can listen to those shows, and in fact, you can keep replaying them to hear this conversation if you're so inclined. It's all there. But Larry Hancock, Larry-Hancock.com, is where you can find Larry's earlier book, and I assume, you can tell me differently, that the new book will also be at that site when it's ready.
Oh, definitely we'll have information about it there, absolutely.
Okay, terrific. All right. So you were saying that we can't tie up the conclusion and put a bow on it as to who specifically paid Ray and said, here's what you got to do if you want to get this money. The other question is, did they in fact pay him, or did they kind of cuff him on the deal? Do we know that?
No, I think we do know that. Actually, that's one of the things we do know. And even Ray himself, and this is one of the few times where he's probably credible, had said that after he left Memphis that he was in a panic. And I think it's clear that he was in a panic. I think what most people don't realize is that he actually literally pulled out from a parking place and was no more than 2 minutes ahead of the police. After the assassination.
Okay.
There were officers on that street within a very short period of time, and fast enough so that they talked to the people who saw his car, you know, racing off, and there was a description on the air of his Mustang within minutes after the assassination.
Wow.
So it was a very close run thing. And strange for Ray in that he left all sorts of evidence behind. He apparently panicked. There may be, and there's some reason to think that if it may have been impulsive, that he was looking, that something happened that he didn't expect to happen, and perhaps he went ahead and took the shot when he shouldn't have, wasn't prepared for what would happen afterwards, or someone else may have taken the shot when he wasn't expecting it. But his escape is very harried, and he ends up back in Atlanta, and there are people that he actually contacts when he gets back into Atlanta, apparently trying to get money.
Okay.
But either he didn't go to where the money was, which is possible, or these people weren't expecting him, or it hadn't come off the way it was supposed to, and he did not get the money, and essentially he therefore starts to escape from the United States by bus, which is another one of those spectacular, it's kind of like Lee Harvey Oswald escaping from the Kennedy shooting by bus.
Right.
Now, you just don't expect this.
Right. Well, actually, in one sense, I suppose maybe that's clever because the cops are looking for a fast getaway car. and the criminal ends up on the slow bus.
Yeah, if you've got time, it's good. That's right. Yeah, that's.
Yeah. Yeah, I was gonna say, as long as you don't have an appointment, bus travel is fine. So the question I have for you is, in terms of him being paid, he apparently wasn't paid, and that might be the reason, perhaps, that he wanted to change his plea so he could involve the co-conspirators and the planners by implicating them by a fully open hearing.
That it there looks like there was a lot going on just exactly to that extent after the fact. Some of the people that he had defend him, some of the approaches he made, there's looks to be a lot of manipulation going on behind the scenes after he's caught.
Yeah.
And after he's even in court. One of the things I should point out, just to kind of finish that escape story, though,
yeah,
people generally have the impression that his escape was somehow well-organized, and the interesting thing is that Ray actually had to go to Canada. He had to come up with his own false identity and paperwork so he could get a flight out of Canada. He did that all himself, and actually he did it by... Well, it's a long story, but the point is the first try didn't work because the person already had a passport, so he couldn't get that one. He had to go through it again. While he's doing this, he even gets a jaywalking ticket in Canada, which I find is humorous. But and then he has so little money that he has to get the cheapest one-way fare that he can, and he gets to England. He ends up even doing two robberies in England just to buy airlines tickets.
Wow.
He goes to Portugal. It's so bad that he's misspelled his name, or his name, even his fake name is wrong on one of his passports, which eventually is what gets him picked up at Heathrow in London. But it really isn't nearly the sophisticated, glamorous escape that some people may have heard of.
Yeah, I had the impression from when all of this happened was that he apparently had a lot of money, which was why it looked like a conspiracy, because he was taking all these trips that most people in those days couldn't afford. But what you're saying is he largely financed those with some more petty crimes.
He'd had to do robberies, and actually even himself, he said, you know, if I'd have done one more robbery, if I'd done a robbery in Canada so that I had enough money to fly through and not make these transit stops, they would have never caught him.
Free.
And
yeah.
He's probably right. He just didn't have enough money to go all the way to where he wanted to go.
Okay. Well, we have all of about a minute and a half left. Again, the time with you has gone extremely quickly. So I'd like to pick this up, and I was just going to look at the schedule. If you're available, perchance, on April 1st, we have an opening, and if not, we'll talk about another date. But you and I will cover that by email.
April 1st now. So appropriate somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a Thursday, so it's just the way the calendar works. But I want to thank you again for joining us. You're becoming something of a regular here. I didn't say you're becoming a regular because it doesn't sound right. Something of a regular here. And it's been great. And for those of you who are interested in what Larry's been talking about, the site is Larry-Hancock, H-A-N-C-O-C-K. Sorry, let me try that again. HANCOCK.com. And join us again next week. We will be having a scientist, a professor on, who will be talking about water treatment. And it actually is much more interesting than it sounds. Larry, thanks again very much. We'll be in contact. And I will let you go. It turns out we've got about 60 seconds left. Any last moment comments?
No, I just to set people up for the next interview, just if we move on to RFK, it gets even more exciting because we can talk about the polka dot dress girl.
That's right.
Which is an escape with the RFK assassination.
Right, and I can tell the story of how I wasn't at the ambassador.
That's important.
All kidding is not just because I wasn't guilty, but I was actually supposed to go that night. It's kind of an odd story.
Anyway, were people there, so it's good you weren't. We'll talk to you later.
Well, we'll do that. Larry, thanks again.
Bye.
Take care. All right. And for the rest of you, thank you very much for joining us. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, please come back and join us next week. Same bat time, same bat station, as they say. We are flattered that you have joined us. And feel free to listen to some of our older shows, but not last week's, in the archive edition. And we have a number of good guests coming up in addition to Larry rejoining us. So thanks again. Have a great night and a good week. Good night.